Have you ever heard a piece of cheese? If not, listen to a story wherein a leading role is played by cheese. This is a story of cheese and its allies in the dairy industry, of cheese and the people who make it, sell it, and eat it. This is a story of the Swiss people who came to Wisconsin, transplanting nearly everything they held dear except the mountains. Listen to our story. And if you hear a sound you can't identify, you may be the first person to hear a piece of cheese.
The Wisconsin College of the Air presents The Story of Greene County, part four of a series entitled Wisconsin Communities. These recorded programs are designed to show the relationship between people and places, why people came here, why they stayed to form a community. Here now is your narrator and producer, Carl Schmidt.
A piece of cheese went out in the mail one day, and out of the mail came a smell. Out of the smell came a story. And here's how the story is told by John Burkhart, the postmaster of Monroe, the county seat of Greene County.
In January 1935, the Dr. Kelly from Independence Highway prescribed Limburger cheese for a lady patient. So the local firm, the Badger Broadhead Cheese Company, shipped some Limburger cheese to Iowa due to the fact that the Limburger was not available in that particular area of the country. The Limburger cheese became rather stinky, and the rural carrier claimed he became sick. So when he got back to the post office, he reported this instance to Warren Miller, who was the postmaster in Independence, Iowa. In due time, the local post office received a letter stating that hereafter, when Limburger cheese was accepted for mailing, it must be properly wrapped so as there would be no odor coming from the parcel. A few days later, another parcel of cheese was shipped, which was examined here before it was dispatched, and apparently everything was all right. Lo and behold, about 3 weeks or 3 days later, the cheese came back intact. I took this package of cheese, wrapped it up, and sent it to then Postmaster General Jim Farley at Washington, D.C. So it wasn't long that the Associated Press and United Press got a hold of this story that I had sent this Limburger cheese to Jim Farley, and immediately calls began to come in wondering what I was going to do next. And at the spur of the moment, I says I was going to challenge Postmaster Warren Miller to a sniffing contest. And they asked me where it is to be held, and I says, well, probably halfway it'd be Dubuque, Iowa. And, of course, this contest was held, and we took our Limburger cheese with rye bread and plenty of the amber fluid over to Dubuque, and all in all, we had a grand time, and Limburger cheese won out.
Limburger won out. That story might be called a symbol of winning out, a lighthearted symbol of Greene County's rise to fame as a leader in the production of foreign-type cheese, Limburger, Swiss, and Brick. The path of that rise to prominence was made by people working toward a better life. They came a long way, these people, literally and figuratively. They brought a language like this.
Auf dem Bild. Hat der Börling rausgezogen vom Käse, nicht wahr?
Ah, ja, toll.
Da bin ich gerade am Mal. Der hat den Stolzplatz da unter Wetter.
They brought with them music like this. They brought the know-how and the desire to make cheese. They brought colorful customs and costumes. They brought tasty foods, such as this one.
Fasnachtriechli.
With a name as delicious as its taste.
Fasnachtriechli.
They were called Glarners. They came from Canton Glarus in Switzerland. A little more than a century ago, Canton Glarus was overcrowded and poverty-stricken. Or, as it was put by Carl Marty Sr., a Monroe citizen who was born in Switzerland.
There was hard times in Switzerland. It was during the 40s there, you know, upheaval here and there. And it got so bad that the council of the old city of Glarus got together and got two men that understood the language a little and knew something about farming and so on to send them out to look for a territory.
But the decision by the Canton Glarus government to send surplus citizens to America wasn't in itself enough to ensure the establishment of a cheese industry in Greene County. There were other factors, factors of chance. They might have gone to Kansas or Missouri, Illinois or Iowa, or elsewhere in Wisconsin. If it hadn't been for lead miners, there would be no Swiss cheese industry in Greene County. Paradoxical? Here's the story, as told by John Schindler, doctor by profession, historian by avocation.
Previous to 1845, there was no dairying here. There were no Swiss here. The way the Swiss got here was because the lead road existed from Mineral Point to Milwaukee. It was because of this road that the two experts from the Canton of Glarus that the Canton sent out in 1845 to find a colony site. It was because of this road that these two experts came through Greene County. They stopped in the New Glarus Woods and walked down through a path that the animals used in going from the woods down to a creek to get water. They walked down this path, looked the site over, and decided that this was a very suitable location for a colony. If the lead road had been, let us say, 5 miles farther north or 5 miles farther south, it's quite probable that the Swiss cheese-making industry might have started in Iowa or Missouri or Illinois. And those states would then have had the Swiss cheese industry and the Swiss dairying, which produces more milk per square mile than any other dairying area in the United States.
But the Glarners didn't bring a cheese industry with them to Greene County. They didn't even bring a cow. At first they tried wheat, but the hills were unsuited to it, and the rains often washed the seeds away before they had a chance to sprout. The hills wore down and warned of barrenness. Then the chinch bugs came and ruined the wheat that had survived. New Glarus was glummer than old Glarus. They finally got cows. A herd of them was chased into Greene County in 1846, and the Swiss colonists bought at $12 a head enough for one cow per family. That didn't make enough for an industry, but it was a step, the first of many. This is one of the places they were heading for.
Mr. Kubley, could you tell us what process we're witnessing here at the Lakeshore Marty Cheese Company?
Well, this is a Swiss cheese manufacturing operation that we're looking at here. At this milk that you're looking at here came in around 7 o'clock this morning, and within a few minutes, the cheese will be taken out of this kettle. Each one of these kettles you see here holds approximately 3,000 pounds of milk. We put about 2,500 pounds of milk in to make a cheese which will weigh around 175 to 180 pounds. What comes out of the kettle and will be Swiss cheese. Whatever is left will be a whey which goes back to the farmer and in most cases uses hog food.
I see. And then the presses over here at the far side of the room is where it's first boxed. Is that right?
Well, that's right. The curd is taken out of the kettle and then it is put into the cheese hoops over there, and then it is put under about 2,000 pounds of pressure, and under the pressure, of course, the cheese is molded into a round wheel of Swiss.
This wheel of Swiss will stay on the shelves of the Swiss room until tomorrow, when it goes to the brine room, into a big brine vat, where it stays a few days to absorb some salt and to develop a rind. Then it spends a few days in the cold room. It's taken from there to a warm room where eye formation occurs and where it's turned and salted periodically. The law requires the cheese be kept in the factory for 6 weeks in summer and 8 weeks in winter. The cheese maker is usually paid on a percentage basis, and he can earn up to $20,000 or $25,000 a year. Back now to the Swiss room and Ray Kubley, manager of the Lakeshore Marty Company.
I wonder now if we could chat with your cheesemaker. Would you introduce us to him?
Yes, I'll do that. Carl, this is our head cheesemaker, Carl Miller.
How do you do? Mr. Miller, could you tell me where most of your milk comes from that you use to make cheese?
It's right around Monroe.
Right around Monroe. About how much milk, Mr. Miller, does it require to keep you in operation for one day here in the Swiss making?
Well, we got about 22,000 pounds right now. See, we'll make 9 wheels a day.
You make 9 wheels a day? And how many times are deliveries made?
Just once a day in the morning.
Every morning, that much milk comes in to be processed. Mr. Miller, are you from Switzerland?
You bet.
How long have you been here?
That's 21 years now.
21 years. Did you come directly to Monroe?
No, I went out west first, out to California.
Did you make cheese there?
No, I was farming there.
And how long have you been here?
Now I'm here for 18 years.
Do you find many things about Greene County and Monroe and New Glarus that remind you of Switzerland?
Oh, it's a wonderful place, Greene County. It's all I can say. I always liked it and made my living here now so far.
The Swiss room of a modern cheese factory. That's an example of where the Glarner colonists were headed inevitably when the first herd of cows came into Greene County. A glimpse at the early cheesemakers now, at their pastimes and their humor, the boisterous humor and the contagious laughter of a hard-working people. A man who came to America at the age of 13 and grew up with the Greene County cheese industry is Carl Marty Sr. He's retired now, and he's documenting the lives of early cheesemakers with his paintbrush. Here he is, recounting the story told by one of his paintings.
There's maybe 6-7 neighboring cheese factories. You know, they were close by, not too far. That was, you had to walk it. And there's always one amongst them had a little hand organ, you know, from Switzerland. And then the packing room at the cheese factories where they made the tops, you know, and where they had the lumber, there's lots of room there to dance. And there they dance, and then some Swiss girls come around, you know, that happened to be around, or their women if they had a woman and so on, and had a wonderful time with a keg of beer. Bread and cheese and a keg of beer. And then that had lasted a few hours in the afternoon, then they all had to pull out and go home and turn their cheese and get ready for the evening's cheese, see? But it was a good pastime for them, and a necessary pastime. Some of them poor devils, most of them were bachelors, you know, they were all alone with that hard work, and it really was a real recreation, just a little keg of beer, innate.
As the appearance of that cheesemaker's party is mirrored in Carl Marty's painting, so the sound of its laughter is echoed in his voice.
That reminds me of a little joke. A fella had a wife, you know, and then it was his turn to have a keg of beer, invited him Sunday, and the cheesemaker went to town, or the farmer went to town with a load of cheese, and he tell him, you go to the brewery and get me an 8 of beer for next Sunday. And the wife says, of course, in Swiss, it sounds a whole lot better. I need a beer. I think a quarter would be plenty. She had the wrong reason. And he says, all right, if you insist, make it a quarter.
The joke of a people who knew their cheese, their beer, and their fractions. The progress from a lonely cheese kettle over an open fire to the long rows of modern steam-jacketed kettles was remarkably steady and free from disastrous setbacks. The depression of the 30s was but a momentary slowing up. The continuation of this trend is being assured largely by modernizing farms and factories. People of Greene County have an intense pride in their cheese industry, a pride that is reflected every 5 years in the largest dairy festival in America, Cheese Day. It's a full-day program consisting of a 2-hour parade in which some 15 bands participate, exhibitions by the Turn Club, a Swiss athletic organization, and, of course, performances by the New Glarus Yodelers. Here's Dwight Crandall, Cheese Day chairman for this year, telling about how many people are expected for Cheese Day and what these people can expect.
In 1940... it was estimated that we had all the way from 50 to 70,000 people here in Monroe. This year, we are planning on having 90,000 people. In the past, there has been a, and still is, a definite problem as to how to take care of that number of people and see that they all get some Swiss cheese. But we feel that this year we have that under control. We're planning on having cheese sandwiches available to the public from 8 o'clock in the morning until 8:30 at night. We are expecting to cut up approximately 15,000 pounds of Swiss cheese alone.
And what day is Cheese Day in Monroe?
September 9th, 1950.
I'm sorry, we missed that. Again, please?
September 9th, 1950.
That's a day to remember, a day to be in Greene County. You'll learn there some reasons for a belief. A belief that cheese is the finest food on earth. You'll learn by tasting. There's a sound as distinctively Swiss as the taste of Swiss cheese. It's a song without words that seeks an echo, a serenade that comes back from the mountain. These yodelers left the mountains behind when they came to Greene County, but none of the gusto is gone from their voices. Euglaris is the yodeling center of Greene County. If you ever visit this town and meet a member of the yodeling club, ask him about the origin of yodeling. His answer will be something like this.
Well, I think that was just because they felt like it, for one thing. They were happy, and when you're happy, you feel like singing. So most of those people didn't know any particular songs, and they just sang something, and when they sang, they could hear the echo, and they liked that, you know.
Paul Grossenbacher, a dairy man who came to Greene County from Switzerland 21 years ago. The yodel served as more than a means of enjoyment, however, for there were cattle in the Alps. Did they come when the farmer yodeled?
Right away.
And were they given anything as a reward for coming?
Yes, we give them a little bit salt when they're coming into the barn.
The answers from...
Oswald Büsser.
President of the New Glarus Yodelers Club, a resident of this country for 22 years. A more common method of calling cattle in Switzerland was independent of the human voice, requiring instead an instrument as long as a man and looking somewhat like a small tree, minus branches, plus polish. Given this instrument with enough lung power and practice, you could make a sound like this. Alpine horn, once a necessary piece of farm equipment, now a collector's item.
Was befällt dir, Herr?
Du stecktest noch einen zweiten Pfeil zu dir. Ja, ja, ich sah es wohl. Was meintest du damit?
If on a Labor Day afternoon you should come to Elmer's Grove, just outside New Glarus, this is what you might hear.
Es muss was anderes wohl bedeutet haben. Sag mir die Wahrheit.
It's a portion of the William Tell pageant, perhaps the most famous bit of Swiss culture brought to Greene County. The German dialogue you hear is between Gilbert Ott, who plays William Tell in both German and English, and Paul Grossenbacher, who plays the tyrant Gessler in the German version. Mr. Grossenbacher, who spent his boyhood years in Switzerland, told us what the William Tell play means to the Swiss.
Well, it is true, William Tell is not recorded in history, but to every child in Switzerland, William Tell was still there. He was still William Tell. I mean, William Tell is to us about like George Washington to the American children.
The Swiss George Washington, part history and part myth, a symbol of Switzerland's winning of independence from Austria. You can see and hear a cultural heritage. You can also taste it. And this time we don't mean cheese. We mean...
Fasnachtriechli.
A tasty food with a tasty name. Mrs. Lena Augsburger can bake the food as well as she pronounces its name. If you hear it before you taste it, you'll probably ask where the name originated.
It comes from a three-day holiday in Switzerland that's celebrated mostly in Basel and Zurich. It's would be called a masquerade or a carnival. Everybody dresses up and they have parades, and which is called Fasnacht. And that's where the Fasnachtkirchli comes from. Everybody makes Fasnachtkirchlis by the bushel baskets full, you might say, and they're celebrating.
They made them by the bushel. And if you've tasted them, you know why. Here's the formula.
Fasnachtkirchli are made. Take 6 eggs, and to each egg, a tablespoon of heavy cream and a pinch of salt. And beat that well, and add flour until you have a nice, firm dough. Then you leave it stand overnight, cover it in a bowl, and leave it stand overnight in your refrigerator or any cool place. The next day you take it out and cut pieces as big as a walnut and roll them out as thin as paper. After you got them all rolled out, you fry them in deep, hot fat. Just quickly turn them and just fry them to a nice golden brown. And you can top them with sugar if you want to.
The result, if you follow Mrs. Lena Augsburger's instructions, is a delicate pastry, round in shape and about 4 inches in diameter. Eat one, and you'll feel capacity for dozens more. These have been examples of the Swiss cultural heritage being preserved in Greene County. There's another side to the Greene County picture, another side that's just as bright, only different. These are the sounds of the Angle, Monroe's Youth Center. We visited the Angle during the rush hour at noon. We talked with Mr. Larry Kitchen, City Recreation Director.
We're wondering, Mr. Kitchen, if you can tell us just what the Angle is.
The Angle is Monroe's Youth Center, sponsored more or less by the City Recreation Department, and it was organized approximately 4 years ago. The Angle takes care of all the boys and girls from 9th grade through 12th grade.
This position that you hold of recreation director, that's rather a new thing, isn't it, for municipalities and communities to establish that type of position?
Well, yes, it is new, although Milwaukee, as perhaps many know, has had recreation a good many years. But the movement is really in its infancy because most communities are just beginning to recognize the fact of municipal recreation. Monroe, I think, being a leader for a smaller community in hiring full-time recreation director.
The Angle at noon is teeming with young students. They come here to dance, to play ping pong and pool, and if they're from out of town, to eat their lunch. Many of them are taking an active part in the government of the Angle, such as the council members we talked with.
Here at the Angle, we're speaking now to Carol Schindler, president of the Monroe Youth Council. Carol, could you tell us just what the function of the Monroe Youth Council is?
I'll try to, Mr. Smith. We are simply here to plan the activities for the coming months or the coming few months. And I'd like to introduce to you a few of my council members here, members on the council with me, and have them explain the activities to you.
Fine.
The first council member is Jeanette Crane. Jeanette, would you like to tell them a little bit about the dances that we plan here?
Well, we sponsor dances after every basketball game and football game. And so a few times we have orchestras to play for them, and the money that we get from these dances is going for our new youth center.
Thank you, Jeanette. Sybil, could you tell us, Sybil Bloomer is next. Could you tell us a little bit about that new youth center, Sybil?
We think we've taken a big step ahead now. We have a new youth center. We've started work on it. The boys are working Saturdays and after school, helping with the working on the plastering and getting cleaned up a little bit. We expect to move in the 1st of April, and we are busy earning money to buy new furniture. We expect to buy about $500 worth of new furniture, as we can take almost nothing with us.
Thank you, Sib. I might add that we're very pleased to be making this step ahead. Ever since we started 4 years ago, we've been getting newer things, and finally, the latest thing is a permanent recreational director for Monroe, and now a new youth center.
Leave the angle now for just a few seconds. During this time, think about headaches, because that's what we'll talk about when we return. What do you do for a headache? Take an aspirin, probably. But an aspirin wouldn't help the kind of headache described to us at the angle by Mr. Herbert T. Johnson, president of the Monroe School Board.
Our big headache is the same headache that many communities have. The wartime crop of babies is now coming into the kindergarten and first grade. Our facilities are overcrowded, and we need additional space. It is the hope of the Monroe School Board that we will be able to expand our grade schools sufficiently so that there will be one room for each grade and one teacher for each grade. At the present time, we are forced in many schools to have one teacher teaching two grades, and these two grades are all confined to one room.
Stand back from the angle again and look at the people you've met. Think of the things they've said. If you're from Monroe, you'll notice that something is missing. What about the youth cabin? Well, that's what we discussed with Henry Kundert, a man well-loved by the youngsters who enjoy the cabin because he devotes most of his leisure time to making the cabin more enjoyable. Back now to the angle.
Sitting beside me at the angle now at lunch hour is Mr. Henry Kundert. We're wondering, Mr. Kundert, if you could tell us something about the youth cabin. We've heard a lot about that since we've been in Monroe. Everyone seems very proud of it. I'm wondering if you could tell us who sponsors it and what some of its activities are.
Yes, I think I can. It was sponsored by the Kiwanis Club. The idea originated about 2 years ago. I think Mr. Frank Huffman was the originator of the idea and had a great deal to do with it. It has really served a very, very fine purpose as far as the young people is concerned. It's out in a beautiful spot, in a little woods, a little clearing, where activities of all kinds can be held. It's going to be good for winter sports, for overnight camping expeditions for the youngsters. There's room for some 30 youngsters there. We have a kitchen that's well equipped, and it is truly a beautiful spot.
Kiwanis, good fellows we meet today. Kiwanis, drive all your cares away. Kiwanis, yours is the spirit free. Kiwanis, drown all your cares in the deep blue sea.
Splendid, splendid. In fact, I never heard such singing.
You're listening to a group of men having a good time. It's Thursday noon in Monroe, and the Kiwanis are holding their weekly meeting. They come here to eat, to sing, and to talk. One of the things they talk about is the youth cabin, because they are responsible for the existence of the cabin. Let's listen to a fragment of the business meeting, a report on the status of the cabin.
The cabin, as you remember, was dedicated last July, and as near as we can tell, we don't have an exact count. About 600 boys and girls of various organizations used the cabin from July on until last fall.
Monroe's only service club. The Kiwanis Club is so called because of things like the youth cabin, because Kiwanians devote much of their spare time doing things without any expectation of personal return, other than the satisfaction that they're doing something good for the community. Well, for the past few minutes, you've heard about some of the things provided by adults to make the community a better place for the young people. Now, here's something the young people provide to make the community a more enjoyable place, both for themselves and for their elders. The Monroe High School Band, an 88-piece band with a fabulous record. A 10-year record of first place in the Class A field, and a 3-year record of more first places than any other Wisconsin high school in solos and ensembles. Directed by Alan F. Barnard, the band averages one public performance per week every month of the year except August. Now here's the band speaking for itself.
High School Band has concluded the first portion of the story of Greene County, part 4 of a College of the Air series entitled Wisconsin Communities. Our recorded program will continue in a moment. This is the Wisconsin State Broadcasting Service. Here again is your narrator, Carl Schmidt.
A small community's most valuable investment has an alarming habit of growing up and leaving. They go away to school or to other jobs. Many of them don't return, and the investment is lost. In Monroe, we talked with a man who went away for a while but decided to return. His story contains at least a part of the answer to this question. What must a community do to keep its young people home? Alvin Babbler left Greene County to attend the University of Wisconsin. When he got his degree, he went to work for a large accounting firm in Detroit. The war interrupted his stay in Detroit, and he entered the Army. The end of the war left him at loose ends. He could go back to Detroit or back to Greene County. This was his decision.
After the war, of course, and I got out, and there was a possibility of going back with Ernst & Ernst. Living conditions in Detroit were crowded. The experience that I had in Detroit previous to that time indicated that the helter and skelter of the city life and the traveling time to and from work and the lack of hospitality in the large city were the things that I didn't care for in living. And feeling that the Monroe, the town that I knew so well, was a town that offered a shorter traveling time, living with people whom I liked, associating with people whom you know and understand, and the possibility of making a living to support my family as well entered into my change and return to Monroe.
If you were planning to go into business in a community, you'd probably talk with the businessmen of that community and ask quite a few questions. If you should ask Alvin Babbler about economic opportunities for a young man in Monroe, this is the answer you would get.
Well, first of all, Monroe is a place where there is economic wealth. And as a result, income in itself is available, assuming the buying public can be unloosened from their money. So that the possibilities for making a living here, providing the right opportunities are available for the individual, are such that any young individual with an education and a energy, an initiative, can find something if he so desires. There are possibilities of making millions elsewhere, but the close community effort that you find in a town of this size is much more gratifying, I think, than living in a town the size of Detroit.
A phrase that arose from our talk with Mr. Babbler set us again in a direction we'd already explored to some extent. The phrase was close community effort. There's an excellent example of close community effort in Monroe, but you aren't likely to realize just how excellent it is unless your house tries to burn down. Monroe happens to have a volunteer fire department. Now, there's a state law which says that any town containing more than 6,500 people must have a professional fire department, unless the volunteers can prove their ability to keep a step or two ahead of the community's requirements. One essential for keeping ahead is keeping in touch with new developments in firefighting technique. H.L. Sickinger, one of Monroe's three fire chiefs, went to a fire demonstration in which a new substance called wet water was used. He was so impressed that he incorporated it into his department immediately. Here's Mr. Sickinger's account of the first fire subjected to wet water.
The fire was going wonderful, and I was called at my home about 12 o'clock and told me where the fire was, and I went down on the back street and met our boys right just before they got there. And I says, now don't use any other water. I says, I want to try this wet water. We got over there and we give it two switches and the fire was out.
As Mr. Sickinger implied in his story, the water didn't run to the fire by itself. How about the volunteers who are busy at other jobs when the siren sounds?
They all leave and come, because every man gets $1.50 for the first hour, and if he is docked from his regular work, he has plenty of pay for his labor.
If you were in the same room with this sound when the fire siren sounded, you didn't hear the siren, but you knew there was a fire. This sound is the same for a wedding as it is for a fire, but if you're in the same building with this sound, you know who was married and whose house burned. No sound is closer than this one to the pulse of the community, yet few people ever hear it. It's a sound you can hear in most any community, but the result in every case is different. In Greene County, the result of this sound is the Monroe Evening Times. A newspaper grows with a community. As a community starts from scratch, so does a newspaper. This was the answer when we asked Emory Odell, publisher of the Times, how it was to start a paper in Monroe 50 years ago.
Pretty serious business, boy, because I wasn't an editor, I was a printer. I come back here as a printer, and then I branched out on the news end. And that is mighty convenient to have been a printer. In the old days, the editors came through the back room. There were no schools of journalism and no big shots. No chance to get any training in college.
Starting a paper in Greene County 50 years ago was serious business, because at that time the men with money to lend didn't take a newspaper seriously. They took it so lightly that Emory Odell had to get 20 signers in order to borrow the $200 he needed. Mr. Odell still has that note. From its vantage point on the second floor of the Modern Times building, that note is the proudest bit of paper in Wisconsin.
Your appointment is for 10:30, Mr. Carson. The elevator is straight ahead and to your right.
To the right. Thank you.
Go to the third floor waiting room and Dr. Marbury will call for you there. Record room, please.
Records.
Case history on John D. Carson, please. Send to Dr. Marbury.
John W. Carson. History to Marbury. Thank you.
Good morning, Monroe Clinic.
Good morning, Monroe Clinic. Good morning from the place which is second only to the cheese industry as an object of Greene County pride. Dr. William Nagy, chief of staff at the clinic, got the idea back in the 30s.
At that time, I had been practicing in Monroe with my father, and up till 1934 had been doing nearly everything that a general practitioner does. I'd become very much interested in the group practice of medicine and thought it would be a fine thing for this community. And Dr. Schindler, who was practicing at Aglaris at that time, in the same way I was practicing in Monroe, had referred several surgical patients to me. I'd come to think a great deal of Dr. Schindler and had lots of respect for his diagnostic ability and the way he handled medical patients. And I, being trained in surgery, thought he might be a fine man to work into a group with. So one morning after we'd finished surgery, I asked Dr. Schindler how he'd like to come to Monroe and start a clinic and practice with me. His answer was, fine, when should I come? That was the beginning of the Nagy-Schindler Clinic. Dr. Schindler and I practiced as a Nagy-Schindler Clinic with the addition of one other man in ear, nose, and throat, Dr. Bristow, until 1939, at which time the Monroe Clinic was organized. At that time, we took in with us to form the Monroe Clinic Dr. W.G. Baer, Dr. L.E. Creasy, and Dr. N.E. Baer. And since that time, we have added several other men to our clinic staff. The clinic grew rapidly, and within a short time, we added Dr. Leslie Kinsey to our staff in internal medicine, and Dr. Fred Kundert, who was a native of New Glarus, to our staff in ear, nose, and throat.
The result has been to make Monroe a medical center. The significance of being a medical center was emphasized by Harold Shearer, the clinic's business manager.
At the present time, the Monroe Clinic draws about 85% of its volume from outside the city of Monroe.
What does that mean in the number of patients, say, per month?
We see on an average of over 5,000 admissions in the clinic each month. That means that the Monroe Clinic is bringing into Monroe approximately 15,000 people each month.
15,000 people each month, and most of them wouldn't come to Monroe except for the clinic. Note that for its importance to a town containing less than 8,000 people. It means a good deal more than a place to have aches and pains diagnosed. It means, to put it bluntly, extra dollars, thousands of them, for restaurants, hotels, and retail stores. People come to a medical center because of the concentration of medical knowledge there. But not everyone has to go to a clinic in order to benefit from it, for medical knowledge is not a stagnant thing. It lives and grows and flows outward. During the past year, more than 15 million people all over the United States and Canada have read or heard of some of the things learned at the Monroe Clinic. It all started like this.
The second thing to learn is learn to like to work. In this world, to get any place, you've got to work. There have been a few that have devised some other methods, but they lead either to the penitentiary or to a political job.
That was a portion of a talk entitled, How to Live 100 Years Happily. An audience of several hundred persons originally heard this talk, but since then it has been broadcast by more than 10 radio stations outside of Wisconsin and printed in 7 publications totaling more than 15 million copies. The speaker was Dr. John Schindler of Monroe Clinic. The occasion, a Farm and Home Week session at Madison on the evening of February 3rd, 1949. His talk was broadcast that night over the state FM network and has been in demand ever since. The first to hear it wanted to read it and wanted to hear it again. With each succeeding broadcast and publication came more enthusiastic response, and so it spread. The remarkable popularity of this talk indicates two things. One, Dr. Schindler is a delightful speaker. And two, the public has a new awareness of and a new interest in the subject of the talk, psychosomatic illnesses. And Dr. Schindler based his talk on the things he learned at the Monroe Clinic. This was what he told us about the development of psychosomatic illness treatment at Monroe.
The interest here began about 1940, when it was apparent that the usual ways of taking care of psychosomatic illness were very inadequate. And we began at that time instituting various new methods for treating this very important disease. And gradually it took the form of what we call the nerve clinic, which has been running here in the Monroe Clinic for the past 8 or 9 years. And it is in that clinic that we have developed the concepts that we're using here in the treatment of psychosomatic illness. And I might say that as far as we are concerned, these methods have completely revolutionized the care of this type of patient.
This is an example of the types of specialized knowledge you can find in the Monroe Clinic. These specialties are the ingredients of thorough diagnosis. The clinic is equipped to find out what ails a person and to help him plan what to do about it. If the plan includes hospitalization, the St. Clair Hospital takes over. St. Clair's a pleasant place to visit, whether you need treatment or information. During our visit, we talked with Sister Blandine, medical supervisor and personnel director, and Dr. W.G. Baer, chief of staff. We learned from Dr. Baer one of the things a community might do when it needs a hospital.
Our old hospital became inadequate. It was not a fireproof building. We couldn't add to it. And we needed a hospital here in this community, and we heard of the St. Agnes Society of Fond du Lac. And Dr. Nathan Baer and Dr. Earl Bromley went up to interview them. And the doctors persuaded them to come down and look over Monroe, which they did later on, and finally decided to build in Monroe.
And does that mean the Sisters of St. Agnes actually furnished the money to build this hospital?
This hospital was financed by the Sisters of St. Agnes, with the exception of the ground, the site. That was given by the doctors of Monroe. Otherwise, the hospital was financed entirely by the Sisters of St. Agnes.
The hospital, originally built by Sister Blandine's order, contained 65 beds, but the multitudes of patients brought to Greene County by the ever-expanding clinic soon required more. The extra room is now being provided. When a construction project now underway is completed, St. Clair's will be able to handle more than twice as many patients as it does today. This interdependence between hospital and clinic has dominated both institutions. The clinic was started only because hospital facilities were available. And now the clinic, or rather the hospital, is doubling its size because of patients attracted by the clinic. Indispensable to each other, they are together of untold economic value to the community, of untold life-giving value to thousands of individuals. When you've been through a community like Greene County, seen its buildings and streets, farms and highways, seen and talked with its people, you often do it all over again in your memory. Fragments of scenes and conversations are piled one atop the other with a subconscious logic to form a new experience. It might sound something like this.
There was hard times in Switzerland.
They're saying they could hear the echo, and they like that, you know.
These methods have completely revolutionized the care of this type of patient.
And the fire was going wonderful.
Pretty serious business, boy.
Is bringing into Monroe approximately 15,000 people each month.
Was noch trierlich?
Sitting beside me at the angle now, at lunch hour.
More milk per square mile than any other dairying area in the United States.
September 9th, 1950.
And Limburger cheese won out.
Pretty serious business, boy.
It is from this reliving of an experience, this reliving tempered by time, that your evaluations should arise. From this perspective, ask yourself some questions. Ask, for instance,
what is the single most important factor in making Greene County a good place in which to live?
The answer? Listen. That's a down-to-earth sound. Down, that is, to a modern, business-like earth. That's the sound of a cash register. Take that sound and multiply it often enough to give Monroe a higher retail index than any other city of its size in the state of Wisconsin. Often enough to give Greene County a net purchasing power of $27 million, and each family a net purchasing power of $3,800. Take the sound in that magnitude, and for a moment at least, you can't hear anything else. Chiefly responsible for these statistics is the dairy industry, and the bulk of that supplied by cheese. That leads to the next question.
What would Greene County be today if the Swiss had never settled there?
For the answer, look outside of the vein of Swiss settlers which runs up through the center of the county, including Monroe, Monticello, and New Blairs. Outside of this area, you'll find the Welsh, the Germans, Norwegians, and the Pennsylvania Dutch, many of whom preceded the Glarners to Greene County. The basis of their livelihood is the dairy industry, because the land on which they live is best suited to dairying. It's reasonable to believe they would have arrived at that conclusion without the influence of the Glarners. The Swiss influence, the Swiss know-how in cheese making, enabled them to attain leadership in a particular phase of dairying, and that leadership has brought greater prosperity. Hence this conclusion. Without the Swiss, Greene County would still be a county of dairymen, but they would lack the extra margin of prosperity made possible by dominance in one particular phase of that industry, dominance in cheese making. All right. The final question now, the most important question.
What does the future hold for Greene County?
The only safe answer to that one leaves you with another question. Look to Greene County's main source of income, the dairy industry. 97% of Greene County's farm income is derived from dairying. And about 90% of Greene County's manufacturing concerns depend on the dairymen for their raw materials. The conclusion? A community so closely allied with dairying will follow the dairy industry's ups and downs. As long as the nation's dairy industry enjoys prosperity, Greene County will be prosperous. These questions and answers are merely suggested as a means of evaluating a community. It's a method that can be used on any community. But if Greene County is your subject, if you're asking about the cheese industry or the Glarners, the youth cabin or the clinic, the answer will be something that permits no indifference. You're either proud of it or you envy it.
This has been The Story of Greene County, part 4 of a recorded series entitled Wisconsin Communities. Our thanks to Dr. William Nagy and Mr. Harold Shearer for their invaluable assistance in the preparation of this program. Narration and production was by Carl Schmidt, and the script was written by Les Nelson. The series is brought to you every Saturday night at 8 and every Sunday morning at 10. Listen again in 2 weeks for The Story of West Bend. This is the Wisconsin College of the Air.